It is Saturday, August 9th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio 889 and KOSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the Geek's affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, and in the studio with me is Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
6 minutes, 40.
Let's see, you're going to need a different mic, sir, I think.
Okay.
There you go. You take three, Ben will take two. Together we'll work it out.
Good morning.
There we are. Thank you so much, sir. And Ben Jaffe, web development instructor, musician, and world traveler. Good morning, Ben.
Oh, hello. Who is that man?
Who is that man? You?
Yeah, that man.
That would be microphones shooting around the room. Oh, who was that? That was NPR news feed that we have on all the time. For some reason, it's Tongle.
Going through the mic?
No, it's Tongle.
It's
slider change. Yeah, it's complicated. I'll take a picture and put it up online. But basically, I sit in front of a board every week when we do this show. Lots of sliders, lots of different feed. We have NPR 1, 2. We have NPR 3, which is like the live news, not really for airing. You want to hear it? Oh, it's a time.
Universal
it's a clock.
Time. There you go. 17 hours.
There he
7
is.
Minutes.
Yeah, so that's
35
what it was.
Seconds.
So it's just a feed right now of. That.
U.S. Naval Observatory.
It's just the time.
Yes, it is. And then we have other things, too, including phone lines and turntables and microphones.
Yeah. Anyone remember dialing popcorn?
Yeah. That did sound like that, didn't it? Of course, you can turn that in on shortwave as well. All right. But let's move on. Last week, we covered a couple stories I didn't think we did such a great job on the conclusion of them. We had a story about child abuse pictures showing up in a Gmail account and a person being prosecuted. And the truth of the story was actually more interesting than we covered last week. I wasn't sure how the decision was made from computer algorithms to say, yes, this person is dealing in photographs that are about child abuse, and therefore it's illegal to traffic those. Sometimes those photos are called child porn, but I don't actually like that terminology. I like child abuse photographs more. I mean, I should say I like labeling them as child abuse because that's the actual problem. In any case, what's going on is there's a giant index of photos that have been seen before that are shown to clearly be child abuse photographs. Humans have seen them and flagged them. And when that database gets collected, they then make a hash, a unique identifying number off that file itself. Then that gets looked at in mass from computers. If that unique signature exists in a photograph, we know that's the same photograph. Therefore, we know it's a high probability of an illegal abuse photograph.
Well, with the hash, it is possible to be another one. You do need a second verification
right.
to make sure that it's the right one.
But. I would say the hash, though, and the file size would do it. But
no, it won't.
Really?
It depends on how big your hash is. But the bigger your hash is, the harder it is to look through the data.
Process them. Interesting.
But there's always a chance of a hash collision.
Yes.
Which...
It depends on the length of the hash, though, and I would assume the length they're using is something in the situation where the chances is 1 in 10,000 or something like that, which is still a high enough probability to take a local look.
1 in 10,000 is very likely
high.
If you have billions and trillions of photos.
Granted. So do you know more about the story? Do you know how much the hash size is?
I know as much as what is public.
Okay. And?
That's the case. You have to go through a hash. But just to say as a general course with regard to software development, the hash is never enough. After you get the hash, then you do a second verification. The hash is there to do the quick lookup. It's like
The only thing that I'd argue about that is that the uniqueness of a hash as it gets large enough is valid.
At some point,
we get to the chance of a collision.
If you have a cryptographic hash,
yeah.
a cryptographic level hash, then yes, the chance of collision are vanishingly small, but they're still present. So you don't want this to be an automated decision.
Right.
And in addition to that, just because something is very unlikely to be a collision, it's still... Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. In any case, the interesting story was that at some point humans did see photographs, label them as such, and then that marked the point where they would investigate. And I think that sounds a little bit better than trying to detect faces and kind of contextual of an image, which is extremely hard to do for computer artificial intelligence.
Yeah, if you were to take an image and then take a just look at every single pixel and then go through every other image and try to compare all of the pixels, it would take forever. That's why you have a hash. But once the hash is found, then you go through these more labor-intensive checks to see, like, yeah, this is actually the same thing.
Yeah.
All right, so let's move on. The other thing we covered last week was bad USB. We did it briefly. One of the things I wanted to mention is the idea is that USB devices can potentially have really bad software that's in them that cause problems. And the thing that's interesting about this story is really about almost every chip manufacturer that produces USB interface chips actually allow the USB chip to be reprogrammed. And it's actually a small computer. And the reason why that's scary is that you can take an off-the-shelf product, you can plug it in, you can then reprogram it, and then it becomes something else. It can run software. So you could take a memory stick, for example, and run software on it. It's not like it has to be made specifically to do that. Almost any USB device can be modified to do that.
Or the case that the worst case scenario that they were talking about is someone buys a whole bunch of USB sticks from a store, gets them out of the package, and presumably they're not one of those packages that are impossible to open.
Right.
They reprogram it and then go, oh, wait, I didn't actually need these. Return back 20 to the store.
Right.
And
so basically buying even a brand new device becomes questionable of whether what's going to happen. And the answer to this is really simple. There's twofold. One is USB manufacturers need to have a fuse burn-in so that after they get their ROM, the actual software runs on the chip of the USB, they can then burn out a fuse, which makes it non-writable. That's one way to do it, and that's important. And then the second thing is the operating system shouldn't necessarily auto-detect and auto-run whatever's on the chip. Instead, it should prompt you in some way saying, yes, this is USB. No, this is the webcam. And then only that protocol will be used on that device, limiting its capability of managing the system. I want to move on, though, because that was just follow-up from last week. So if you want to hear more about that, listen to last week, but modified by what we just talked about. But Star Trek convention, Ben.
Yeah,
sci-fi in general. Let's talk about that. You were there.
I did not listen to your show last week.
Yeah,
so thanks for the quick rundown.
We also covered... No, I'm just kidding. Go on.
I was at the Star Trek convention in Las Vegas. So that's a Creation Star Trek convention in Las Vegas. And it was really fun. The last time I was at a Star Trek convention, I think I was maybe 9 or 10 years old, and so that's like two years ago or something.
Yeah,
I see.
I
knew you were going to make that joke. But yeah, so it's been a long time. Actually, my claim to fame, incidentally, when I was last at a Star Trek convention when I was 9 or 10, I won the costume contest.
What'd you go as?
I went as Data. So we put a whole bunch of baby powder all over my face to make me white, and I as we were walking out the door to go to the convention, my mom said, wait, hold on. Bring this cat, because they had a cat, and that is what won me.
You brought a cat with you? A real cat?
Fake cat.
Okay.
A stuffed cat. So anyway, but yeah, so a couple things that I noticed. One is
Hang on a second.
Yeah, please.
We need photographs of that whole thing.
That's my Google profile picture. Oh, no, now everyone's going to go Google
there
stop
you go.
Me.
All right, go on.
But it's way more expensive. Everything is way more expensive. I mean, part of it is that it's Las Vegas, right?
Right.
But also, just nothing cost that much for at Star Trek conventions, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Or wait, 15, whatever, 15 years ago.
Well, they were trying to keep true to the series.
Yeah, I guess so.
Here's some old rubber. It's a rock.
But anyway, it was really fun. Also, this made me really happy. NASA had a presence.
Okay.
So there were actually quite a few talks by NASA. One was about living in a crowded universe. When the original series back in the 60s first aired, the top scientists thought that the universe was pretty much barren and cold and desolate and lifeless. And we were this bizarre floating oasis of life, and we were unique. But we now know that that is very, very unlikely to be true. And so one of the people from NASA gave a really wonderful talk, John Day, I think was his name, about how crowded our universe actually is likely to be. And there was another talk about science fact versus fiction, which was really great to watch. And
did you meet the actors?
I did. Yeah, I had a long conversation with Aaron Eisenberg, played Nog on DS9. And also a couple other Ferengi and Chase Masterson. Who else? Saw a bunch of the Next Generation cast. And we left on Saturday evening. William Shatner appeared on Sunday. But I don't know. That's okay with me. I didn't see William Shatner. Bummer.
All right. Well,
but I can watch Priceline.com commercials, you know, and see him there.
So there's your geek cred just up to notch. You're going to Star Trek conventions. Congratulations,
Ben. It was so much fun.
The question I've got for you is, you were right after the show last time you were on, you mentioned that you were actually going to bring your girlfriend with you to the show, and she didn't know that that was happening. It was a surprise.
Oh, yes.
And I went, gulp. How'd that go?
It was fantastic. Okay. She was really, actually.
Even though she's not a Trekkie, she enjoyed the show.
So she knew that there was a surprise.
Right.
And she knew that it was, that we had to block out several days for it. The only thing she could imagine it could be was a Star Trek convention.
So she figured it out.
She figured that. She guessed that part, but she didn't actually guess it. She just kept her guess to herself. She didn't know it was going to be in Las Vegas. So we ended up getting on the plane and going to Las Vegas.
Right,
that was
cool.
The surprise. But yeah, it was really fun.
All right, let's talk about some other Star Trek news. Miles?
There's a series that I've recently become aware of called Star Trek Continues. It's some folks some fans who've made a web series talking about the original Star Trek Enterprise. So they have someone cast as Kirk and someone as Spock. And
do they redo the series?
They're not redoing the original stories. They're doing fan stories.
So they're new episodes.
New episodes, yeah.
Oh,
in other words,
neat.
Trying to fill up past that original 80, you know?
Yeah. So I've seen a little bit of fanfic in my day, or fan videos. I have not seen this one. How have you seen it? How's the production value and the writing and everything?
It's very similar to the original series.
All right.
So. The thing is, the original series, in terms of their production value for a major network, for today, it just becomes anyone can do that as long as mm-hmm. they have the time and energy and desire. And so I recommend it, and we'll put it up on GeekSpeak on the website later on today.
That's cool.
Cool. So I'll just throw in one little Star Trek story. If you haven't heard of the Twitter handle TNG_S8, we've talked about it before. That would be The Next Generation Season 8, which never actually existed.
That's the reason I still check Twitter. That's the only reason I still check Twitter.
It. Basically, it's someone blogging synopsis of stories and subplots in episodes that never existed as if the season kept going.
But
they're fun.
But they're all comedic.
They're all
humorous.
Comedic, yeah.
They're basically taking all of the stereotypes, magnifying them, and then somehow distilling that into a bizarre story.
And so now that Picard is playing poker with the rest of the executive staff, he's always losing. And it becomes very uncomfortable. No. I don't know. I've never seen this series. I was just trying to...
Well, you've never seen the series.
No.
What? So you've never seen the Next Generation series?
Season 8, no.
Well, Season 8 didn't exist.
No, I know, but I mean like this
comedic thing. Okay.
It is so funny.
What other, Miles, what other sci-fi, I mean, Star Trek's kind of a canon, of course, that everybody loves and adores. Any other science fiction television shows that you had a liking for?
Yes, Babylon 5, although I do say that a bunch of my friends had a much greater liking for Babylon 5 than I did. It was still entertaining to watch, but it is being rebooted, and it looks likely to become a big-budget film.
Babylon 6?
No, Babylon 5 was the last of the Babylon stations. Don't you remember the intro?
I actually have never seen Babylon 5.
Dude,
what
is wrong with you?
Have you seen Deep Space Nine?
Yes, of course I have.
You have?
Yeah.
To boldly sit where no one has sat
In fact,
before.
I recently
Oh,
this
sitting is so interesting. Sometimes people watching is more fun than walking around.
Yeah, I actually say that Deep Space Nine has aged very well.
Mm-hmm.
I went to watch it again, the whole series with my wife recently, yeah. And it was also really dark and it really touched upon some philosophical quandaries and moral gray areas.
Yeah, that's good.
Mm-hmm. That
the one thing about it, though,
really
didn't
nice.
Fit the Star Trek canon very well that was originally set up, which is an optimistic future where humans work together, right? And it's more about war is the problem with Deep Space Nine for me. I think it's a great science fiction. It just doesn't fit in the other shows as well.
Well, it's not exactly true to Roddenberry's vision. That's definitely true. But I mean, the idea is if you look at, and they actually touch on this in Deep Space Nine, they address this pretty directly. If you look at Earth, which is kind of the center of the Federation, or you look at the Enterprise, which is the flagship of the Federation, of course everything is going to be peaches and roses and
right.
happy and everything's going to work perfectly and everyone's going to get along and all the problems will come from the outside. But that's never really real life, right? And so what happens when you get to the outskirts of the Federation? So anyway.
So
in fairness, yeah. I actually disagree with that characterization that it doesn't really fit the rest of canon.
Go on.
Because you have, for example, in the original series, you have all sorts of conflict. In The Next Generation, you have all sorts of conflict and how do we get along with the Klingons and are we going to be at war with the Romulans
sure,
and stuff like
sure.
that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get into Deep Space Nine, you still have this, even though everything seems like it's falling apart or almost at the edge of falling apart, everyone still keeps trying.
Yeah.
Everyone still has this goal and they still keep going. And that, I believe, is absolutely part of
the conflicts in Deep Space Nine is they're enduring conflicts with the same characters continually. In Star Trek, the episodes with Enterprise, you have an episode or maybe three episodes around a certain problem set, but then you move on. And you actually literally, they move on. They go into different parts of space. So those conflicts resolve themselves from distance, right? In a much cleaner way and much more, you know, episodic way. In Deep Space Nine, the storyline...
Until Tasha Yar went back into time and had a baby that turned out to be a total nemesis.
Let's move on anyway.
We don't like to talk about that episode.
That was a recurring villain.
That's the real difference, I think, between Deep Space Nine and the rest of the series, is that Deep Space Nine is not episodic. It's meant to be a larger arc.
Yeah.
And
like Babylon 5, by the way. When Babylon 5 was designed, it was supposed to be a 5-year show, and they had the plot points the entire time. So it has an interesting close. I think they have some episodes in there that are kind of fluff episodes, but in general, I think Babylon 3 can is pretty great.
It was ahead of its time.
Production values were nowhere near Star Trek.
That's what we have now, too. Big arcs in television shows now.
That's very common.
DS9.
Yeah. All right. Let's... I love your Star Trek desires. All right, listen to Geek Speak. We'll be right back. Next time on the 7th Avenue Project, how not to be wrong. Numbers can provide extraordinary insight into how the world really works. But they're often misused and misunderstood by journalists, pundits, and even scientists. KOSP's Robert Pauly talks to mathematician Jordan Ellenberg about some of the big errors we make and how we can do better. That's with numbers, of course. Next time on the 7th Avenue Project, that's tomorrow here on KOSP. You are listening to KOSP. This is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me is Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe. We've been talking all about sci-fi and a lot about Star Trek. Ben, one more Star Trek thing.
Yeah, I've got one more, and I love this one. So back in 2010, Leonard Nimoy, who played the Vulcan Spock on Star Trek, was quoted as saying, when he arrived to the town of Vulcan, he said, I've been a Vulcan for 44 years. It's about time I came home. So they made news in 2010 because of that quote. Well, now they're kind of making news again. They have an Indiegogo campaign, which is similar to Kickstarter.
Sure.
You can donate and everything. And they are trying to build the USS Enterprise. Now, whether
as an attraction, not as a spaceship.
No, as a spaceship. No, they're talking about developing the warp drive and all.
Oh,
and the other thing is, like, there's a lot of overlap between the science fiction of Star Trek and the science facts and theories and everything. So, you know, they've got this very interesting Indiegogo campaign going. They are trying to raise...
This is the town of Vulcan?
The town of Vulcan, Alberta. This is up in Canada. They're trying to raise $2 billion. $2 billion. And this is the first step towards building their 40-year USS Enterprise, which they've budgeted as costing $1.132 trillion.
Plus science that isn't real. Need that too.
The money will make it real. Now,
all right.
So this has been going. This campaign started on the 5th of August, so it's been going for what, 4 or 5 days now. They currently have $896 pledged of their $2 million amount. So anyway, you could dive in on this and try and help them. But anyway, I mean, they made a whole video and everything, and they've got a very detailed timeline of, like, where do they develop all the legal and logistics and where their advisory boards are and all the stuff and prototyping. So anyway,
all right,
good for a laugh. Unlikely to come true, but
In the third part of the Geek Speak episode today, we will talk about some real science, some astronomy and things of that nature, which will be fun to
science
close
fact.
Out. Science fact. That was a good science fiction section. But first, let's talk about some more contemporary, current day, real world touching stuff. Google announced recently that they are going to change the way their search engine works in a really interesting way. They're going to give preferential search result treatment. This is the weighting of the search results that currently exists. And keep in mind that the weighting of search results is a major industry, because if you show up higher in the search result lists on Google's index and any other search engine, but mostly Google, you get more traffic and therefore most likely you're more successful and therefore your website makes money. And if you lose your rating, you don't make as much money. So there's a whole cottage industry trying to beat the algorithms of Google so that they can put themselves higher up. And there's a large team, I'm assuming, at Google that tries to reduce that. But one weighting they've just decided to induce is this idea that if you're providing web traffic from a secure website, meaning you're using the HTTPS like your bank does, like Twitter does, like Google does, if you do that, Google will actually rank your content as higher.
So you get preferential ranking because your site is more secure.
Because it's an SSL cert site. That's right. And I'm assuming the reason they're doing this, and maybe you guys have more ideas of why they're doing this, is to promote this content. But it might just be that there's a little bit more energy and involvement in making an SSL cert work on a site. It's a little more expense. There's a little more time and energy. And theoretically, if you looked across all the sites and all the traffic that had stories, the ones that have SSL certs are probably have more time and energy invested, and they're probably better content than the ones that don't. That's just a thought, though. The other reason to do this, of course, is that it will kind of make an era where everyone has to have an SSL cert, which, from as a web developer, I highly recommend. Mm-hmm. Do you have more ideas on this that you want to share about?
One, with regard to the expense, it is possible to get a free cert. So
yes.
It's not like, and I don't mean just a self-signed one, because a self-signed one
Useless.
Is usually a bad idea. if you're not doing it for your own local company, for yourself. But, for example, there's startssl.com. Free certs, they're bare bones. They're very simple. Like, you get a domain name and you put it up there and you're ready to go. But at the same time, that's all we're talking about here is, can you get into a secure channel and something that authenticates that, yes, the person is talking to who they think they're talking to? And
maybe we should lay down this technology a little bit for people. We do talk about it on the show every once in a while, but we could clarify how this works.
Well, just in a nutshell, it could just be when you have HTTPS, it means two things. You know exactly who you're talking to, and no one else can eavesdrop.
Right.
That's basically what it comes down to.
Yeah. So if I go to my bank and it says HTTPS, I know that they are my bank. They're not someone posing as my bank, and there's no one in the middle listening.
Yeah, and when we say that we know the bank, part of the rule about getting a certificate, FHBS certificate signed, is that some other body has to guarantee that you are who you say you are. That's the idea behind it, at least. Actually, that's why some of the secure blocks, if you will, are different colors and stuff. There's actually a higher level of trust at certain types of certs. And I would say the highest level certs still cost money.
Right. And some people may say, but I typed in, you know, www.bankofamerica.com. Isn't that going to be bankofamerica.com? DNS... domain name service.
Or system.
It's the way that translates names into IP addresses or the internet phone numbers.
It's how when you type in a domain, you get to a site because it gets translated to an IP address.
That has historically been the weakest link in security for the internet.
In fact, theoretically, if you're on we have a Wi-Fi network here at KOSP, and if you were running code on your machine that was trying to spoof DNS, and I asked for, you know, geekspeak.org, you could respond faster than the DNS servers with the same information saying it's a different location. My machine would completely look like I was going to the right place, but in reality, you were redirecting me. Not because you had any authority, just because you happened to be in the same network.
Right.
And I get redirected. Now, if I don't have an SSL cert, show up on that site, I log in, all that. It's really Miles's hack of a GeekSpeak site. Unless I've installed an SSL certificate and my browser knows that. And so there is a problem
that
there.
That happens automatically.
If you do an HTTPS, yeah, that's all relatively automatic. The one thing is that request, when I first make the request, it being HTTP, theoretically, if you intersect it and then never deal with the cert on that hacked site, that's a vulnerability that we have.
But
one of the reasons why that exists is that we don't do preferential treatment to HTTPS. If more people were using HTTPS, all websites were like that, then browsers could kind of enforce this idea that I'm going to check at HTTPS first. I'm going to make sure to go there if it's possible. And if it's not possible, then I'll revert back.
But another thing is, if you have a organization that you're going to on a regular basis, like a bank, like some financial entity, then they can actually set up headers that
say, never go to
we are only HTTPS. And so once your browser has seen that the first time, it will never try to do HTTP. So that actually could protect you in that case.
So the long and short of it is, if you have any kind of business right now where you are reliant on traffic on your website and it's based off of Google searches or any searches, you really do need to get into an SSL certificate. And I just recommend people do it anyway. In fact, GeekSpeak doesn't run an SSL cert because it's been this kind of free thing. We don't care much. We don't have any people log in except for ourselves. So it's time for GeekSpeak to get an SSL cert, and this is going to be kind of my motivation factor. I'll go ahead and work on it as I always do by myself anyway, guys.
Oh, I'm sorry. Always work
on
yourself.
Well, you did it for 4 years or 5 years. That's true.
So another caveat to this, though, is that normally one cert works with one IP address. And there are many hosting providers that support many different sites on a single IP address called Vultr Hosting. And there are ways around this. There is something called server name indication and SNI. And that does allow you to have multiple certs associated with a single IP, and then you can have a communication line that says, hey, I'm trying to go for this one, give me the right cert for that, and then we'll continue our conversation. It is not, however, supported by anyone who's running Internet Explorer on XP.
Mm.
And it never will.
Right. So those kinds of certs on XP will look like they're bad certificates.
Yes, they will never be able to connect up to the site.
Yeah. So maybe it's time to upgrade your operating system. I don't know.
Right.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, so there's some – so this is a case where if you are still running XP, first off, please stop.
And if you're not stopping, go to Chrome.
Yes, get Chrome or Firefox or Opera or any other browser but Internet Explorer.
Definitely.
Any other browser.
But all right. I feel like a horse is being –
it's one of those things that I think it needs to be. This is actually a major security vulnerability for people.
There is a story actually about Microsoft and IE this week, which is Microsoft is now going to be, well, not now, I'm sorry. Microsoft soon will be dropping support for older versions of Internet Explorer. So that's going to be on January 12th, 2016. This is wonderful, wonderful news for any web developers like us. So what will be happening is once January 12th, 2016 comes around, Microsoft will only be supporting Internet Explorer, the most recent version available for whatever operating system that is supported. So if you're using XP, XP is not supported, so it doesn't apply to you. You shouldn't be using XP. Get off XP. If you're using, say, Windows 7, then you'll be able to run whatever the latest version of IE that runs on Windows
7. And they'll support that.
And they will support it.
Which means that if they release a patch and you haven't applied the patch, you don't get support. You have to auto-apply patches.
Now, web developers out there, don't get too excited because Windows Vista is still supported and will be for some time.
Hmm.
And the maximum version you can run on Vista is version 9.
Yeah.
Almost no one wanted to use Vista.
I feel like the only thing that's been consistent. We've been doing the show for...
Windows ME was a much worse animal.
Miles, we've been doing the show for about 14 years or so, right? Something like that? Since 2001. Yeah. Okay. So, 2001, so 13 years.
2000.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, 2000. September 2000. Okay, so we've been there that long. The only consistent thing, we've changed time, we've changed geeks, we've changed theme songs, we've changed, everything.
Well, some geeks.
We've changed basically everything on this show except for one thing. I think from day one, we've talked about getting away from Internet Explorer, and we're still saying it. I really think it might be the only consistency.
No, we're still in the same room. Still
no,
in the same
no,
station.
Wasn't the studio changed?
Oh, it was. Yeah.
This is boring. Wow. I mean, everything's different. Kind of amazing. Anyway, get away from Internet Explorer. I mean, during the length of the show, we've seen FireWire. What is it? 10.8? What was the FireWire? Yeah, FireWire, right? Yeah, FireWire protocol emerge and disappear.
It's still around.
No.
It's still around, but.
It's still around, yeah, but so are.
But
so
is.
Than floppies are.
So is. So are floppies.
Hey, speaking of something, okay, so let's talk about a dead horse again. Facebook's making a decision that is affecting a lot of people because, of course, any decision they make actually affects a lot of people, being the largest service that any internet service anybody uses. Facebook has been pushing a modification to their app, their mobile app, to split you from the Facebook app experience and add a new app called the Messenger. And basically, these two apps would work together on your phone, and you would do all your instant messaging style texting through the Messenger app. And they've been pushing it hard, and I've been not doing it. You guys, have you switched over to this thing?
I installed Facebook Messenger, and then I thought, why did I install this? Well, I only installed it because they're basically making me install it, which makes me want to uninstall it, so I removed it. No.
I saw it and went like, I don't want this, and then moved on, and then saw the messages of the Messenger is going to go away, and you're not going to be able to get messages through this anymore unless you install this. And I thought, okay.
Yeah, I don't need to do messaging through
I have
Facebook.
So many lines of communication right now.
You need to contact
one viewer,
me. It's not a problem.
Like, all of my friends have a way of contacting me.
What's great about this story is that Mashables posted a little story looking at the analysis of the usage on the apps. Now, Apple doesn't actually release how successful apps are, but you can look at the data on their ratings and things to determine some stuff. You can do it by different areas, like different different countries and things will give you different numbers because these are all language-based.
Well, you don't know absolutely how popular they are. You only know them how relative to other apps.
Right. So
and
relative,
it's all in French.
The relative popularity, the relative popularity of the Messenger app on the App Store is it's number one right now. It's the most downloaded application.
It's
right
the top
now.
App.
Yes. It also has a rating of one. It's in the lowest rating possibilities.
One star.
1 star out of five.
Yeah. And so if you look at the statistics, we got like the current version of the app has 218 people rating it, and 192 of those rated it 1 star. Like, it's really bad.
Oh, man. That's rough.
Yeah.
As this is going on, a lot of people are saying they don't want to have it, especially on the various platforms.
Yep.
Some have more issues than others. I do wonder if enough people get upset about it, if Facebook will go like, all right, we'll put it back in the original app.
Well, Facebook's is a pretty nimble company, right? They're definitely looking at this and going, oh, there's a problem here. And of course, okay, so, but keep in mind, let's say on the app since its existence, right, the Messenger app, not just the current version, but the entire existence of the app, has had 6,000 reviews, 6,422 reviews. That's a really high review count. Of that 6,422 reviews, 5,882 of them are one star. Right, so we're talking about a massive level. In fact, 5 stars is only 275 people. That's only the people that work on the app. It's really bad. So the question is, the reason why Facebook is doing this, I'm assuming, is because they want to own messaging. They want to just use their service as the messaging protocol. But in iOS,
well, I could see there being case where you want development to be simpler. Mm. So you have just the timeline is one app and just the messaging and chat is another app. That's
the thing is, if you're not insane, your Facebook app always has flags of people that are trying to contact you and stuff. They post in your timeline, they add a picture of you and flag you. And so there's lots of like alert messages that show up based on Facebook that really should be checked out when you feel like doing that. Different than when someone texts you, that's more like, hey, I need you to pick up groceries, right? There's a different level of communication that's going on with messaging versus just timeline spam. So that's one of the reasons to separate, just because the interface doesn't allow for badging or notification that there's two different types of messages here. So that's a big reason why they want that separated. I use Google Hangouts quite a bit with some people that use that. That also is a texting service, and I actually have it tied through my phone number. So when I do text messaging, I'm actually doing it through that service to some degree. And it's still difficult in iOS to do that because Apple wants to own Messenger with their app Messenger, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's these large people are playing against each other, and I can't imagine anyone really winning on the phone except for the operating system installed one, and Apple doesn't allow any other ones to be installed at that level.
Well, I have friends who installed Hangouts, and the only caveat is that they also got their friends and family to install Hangouts.
Yeah.
And
that works.
And that works for them quite well, in fact, better than text messaging. And it's not altogether unlike iMessage.
Right. It's the same type of thing.
The only thing is that it can't integrate with the same interface with
the reason why the reason why iMessage works so fluidly is it doesn't matter who you're talking to. If you're texting them via their phone number and you're using iMessage, theoretically you'll get to their phone. That's also unless they used to have an Apple phone and now they have an Android phone, in which case it doesn't work.
Yeah. Or in the case where for some reason it switches over, even if they have an iPhone or an iOS device and says use text message, and then suddenly it won't ever not do that.
Yeah.
Which I've come across with several occasions. And it's just like, I don't want to pay for this text.
Also, we know that iMessage, the messaging protocol by Apple, is not a secure protocol because they can actually intercept and read the messages. So you have to trust Apple's not doing that. Other services that do messaging could theoretically have it be black box where they can't see it. They can encrypt on both sides. Facebook's not doing that either because they want to be able to place ads and read that text message as well. So any case, I personally am not going to upgrade to Messenger. Or, I'm sorry, side grade to Messenger. I just stop using Messenger, Facebook. That's not a big deal for me.
So we call it side stall?
Side stall. I like side stall. It's kind of like a stalling out.
Yeah. Install, outstall, and side stall.
You're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe. We're talking now about science news. Let's talk about some space news. Miles?
Well, we can talk a little bit about astronauts.
That's a good thing to talk
those
about.
Those are really cool people. And unfortunately, people don't talk enough about what are the qualifications for being an astronaut. Like, you should probably have a strong background in engineering. Many people who are astronauts also have a PhD in a science.
Yeah, these guys are incredible.
Right.
These people are incredible. And the training and the physical training, too. Mm-hmm. Just, like, it's incredible.
And what they found when tracking different astronauts, because you have a limited amount of time in space. You need to get stuff done. You have, and astronauts don't just get to go out there and, hey, I'm going to spacewalk for
a while.
What
are you doing tomorrow? I'm just going to hang out, play some ping pong.
And they don't get to just, you know, all those videos that you see are them usually having fun. But really, every time a shuttle went up, every time an experiment goes up on the International Space Station, the astronaut's time is blocked out into
and
very
cosmonauts,
fine grain.
Right? Yeah. All the space people,
Is blocked out into these very small times where they have, you know, 2 days to run 2,000 experiments.
Right.
To go like, okay, I got to set this thing up. Got to set this thing up. Okay, move this over here.
And there's outside requests of their time for other experiments. Like, there's always more to do, right? They limit it to a certain set that the person can do. But really, if you had any extra time, you just put another experiment in there. Go on.
And what they found for astronauts working on the International Space Station was that they get just over 6 hours a night, which for some people it works out, but it's on the low end. Most people need between 7 and 9 hours of sleep. And what they find is that the official NASA guidelines are saying that astronauts are ordered to get 8.5 hours of sleep every night.
But they don't.
But they don't. And it is taking its toll. And so when they're finding that when they have to get someone awake to work on something, you're going to have more errors come up. And you're going to have the risk of people, you know,
not being top performance, right?
Yeah. Sure. People trying to use sleep-promoting pharmaceuticals, trying to get to sleep, which then causes this whole set of physiological problems.
It's also hard to sleep in space. It's not like you're in a nice bed or anything.
Yeah, I think if I were put into space right now, I'd have a hard time sleeping.
Right, so, and as a point of context that found in this article, they'll be posted on GeekSpeak, the website later, is that 15 to 20% of all fatal airline crashes, human error, and most human error, sleep deprivation.
Yeah, okay. All right, so, you know, I always hear about these sleep studies where clearly this is showing that if you don't get the right amount of sleep, then you are degraded in your performance. And most people, kind of a problem, especially driving vehicles. For astronauts, could be really serious problems.
Right. For a coder, like, there's a whole lot of bugs that have been caused by this.
Oh, man.
Fortunately, I have to for the most sleep part, no one dies because of it. That's why a lot of software also has those clauses. Don't use this in a nuclear reactor or some safety context or an airplane.
But I've got to say, these things are always all. Most people need 7, 8. How do you know how much sleep you actually need? How do you actually determine that?
For most people, it's you go to sleep and then when you wake up, that's.
Yeah, but I have children and a puppy. I don't wake up because I want to wake up. I wake up because alarms go off or a child's all of a sudden throwing up on me. I mean, there's lots of reasons why I wake up.
Right, and when that happens, chances are you're not getting enough sleep.
That happens all the time.
Yeah, and chances are you're not having enough sleep.
What you're saying is I should just start going to sleep earlier and earlier, and then if I ever wake up without being woken up, I'm succeeding.
One thing that has...
Hang on a second. I got to go to bed right now.
Something that has helped for me is, and it's kind of my mutant superpower, is that I can nap at any time. So when my daughter goes down for a nap, I do too.
You're lucky.
I am so upset with you right now. You're sitting right next to me.
Why?
I cannot do that.
Because you can't go to sleep?
I cannot do that. I mean, once I'm
out... You should
out,
be an astronaut.
Once I'm out, I'm pretty much out. So that's kind of a superpower, but it's nothing like... Like, I knew a stage manager who... No, I'm sorry, not a stage manager. Had the headset on in the theater, and she would go to sleep between her calls.
Wow.
So the stage manager would say, stage left, get ready for it, and she'd wake up and cue someone and go right back to sleep. It was
Tell
amazing.
Us about space news and space exploration, Ben.
My name's not Miles.
No,
this I can't
Miles.
Go to sleep like that. Comets.
Sleep deprivation at work.
It's true. So, I didn't get to sleep last night.
Yeah, I got tons of sleep last night. I'm feeling great right now. Comets are pretty awesome. And up until now, we've flown by 6 comets with our various spacecraft and taken pictures and tried to study them.
Comets specifically are objects that go into deeper space or go to the asteroid mm-hmm. belt and then circle the sun coming into close orbits. These are, and normally they're icy and they actually have tails. And
exactly.
Halley's is one of the famous ones that happened from my childhood.
Hale-Bopp,
sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
I love that comet.
And actually, the ones we see are massive, like very different. There's a lot more that we don't actually see.
There are a lot of comets. Yes, definitely. And not all of them have tails,
right.
Or they have small tails. So we actually just got into orbit around one, which is quite a feat. Yeah, but
we have a craft that went into orbit of a comet.
We have a craft which 3 days ago entered orbit
of
a comet.
Whoa. Wait, how?
Yeah, that just happened.
And this is, how did you miss this?
I did hear about this, but I like the excitement of my voice, so I'm going to keep going with this idea.
All right.
Wait, so how would you do that? Because I thought these things are traveling. I mean, they're going to orbit the sun. They're going to be thrown way out. How can they be going at a speed that we can get relative to?
Well, they don't necessarily. You just got to match the trajectory, right?
Yeah, they don't necessarily go at extreme speeds. Some comets are... They just take a really long time to get around.
Okay, good.
I mean, to be fair,
so clearly not getting that close to
our spacecraft. Did a couple. What are they called?
Passes.
Yeah, passes of different bodies like Earth
sure.
and Mars to get enough energy.
Well, the reason why it excites me, you guys, is this: a comet normally has a duration, but it comes into the early to the closer solar system, right? Mm-hmm. The rocky body solar system part where we are, and then it goes out past where to the asteroid belt and further sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's the idea that we could take an object and do that because now that it's orbiting, it's going to keep orbiting, right? It's just going to travel out whatever its trajectory of the asteroid is, it'll alter it a little bit, but basically it's going to do the same thing the comet's doing. It's going to go out to the full path.
Right now our orbit is 100 kilometers up. We're going to land on it.
Yeah, awesome.
And that is going to be awesome. Now, also a couple interesting things, and I'm putting a whole article about this with tons and tons of information and pictures.
Geekspeak.org.
Yes. One thing that I love about this particular comet is it kind of looks like a rubber ducky.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I'll show you a picture after the show. And we have a 3D picture of it. So if you have any of those red and blue glasses at home or anything, you can go on this website that's up on, it'll be up on geekspeak.org and take a look at a 3D.
How long was the mission to get to orbit it? How long did it take?
It took years. Let me see.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It took a while.
Okay. 10 years.
10 years. Yeah. Okay.
10 years to the rendezvous.
Now. Nice seeing how we did this. Okay, good.
Oh, yeah.
This was
a couple months ago we started planning.
Just getting there isn't the hard part. The hard part is making sure that you can match velocities once you get there.
Well, that's what I mean. Orbiting is the hard part.
Right.
The hard part is getting to the right
velocity. It's all hard.
Nah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And fun fact, even though it has a very small amount of gravity because it's very small, our spacecraft also has some. So by interacting with it, we have changed the course of that comet's destiny.
And in 10 million years, that comet will hit Earth because of us.
No, it really won't.
No.
You know, there's
10 billion years, you don't know.
There's actually a fun term for that, gravitational tethering. So if you park a heavy spacecraft right next to an asteroid, then they'll attract each other, and the asteroid will start to move off of its normal trajectory. And then if you fire some thrusters and move your spacecraft a little further away, it'll keep doing that. And you can actually modify the course or the path of a comet or an object or an asteroid or whatever.
As long as you see the asteroid 10 or 20 years before it hits the Earth.
Exactly. Armageddon was a horrible idea. You just don't throw nukes at something that's so huge because what happens to the pieces?
The description of that gravitational tethering that this spacecraft and this comet have done sounds to me kind of like the way I've understood Pluto works, where there's a secondary body or something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Its moon, sure. Or one of its moons.
One of its moons.
Yeah.
Do you have a story about that, right?
Yes, I do. It is the... Well, first off, there's still people who are upset that Pluto is...
Got demoted.
...called a dwarf planet now.
Got side-moted to a dwarf planet.
What?
There are quite a few people that are trying to, as NASA's New Horizons spacecraft is heading toward Pluto, we'll take some close-up shots. There are still folks that are saying, hey, can't we just call it a binary planet? Because you have... Charon is a non-trivial percentage of the size of Pluto. And as they orbit each other, you can actually see the wobble, visually see the wobble in Pluto.
Right.
As it goes around.
The center point that both of these objects rotate around is not inside of Pluto.
I thought it was
I think it's just above the surface. I might be wrong about that. Maybe you're right. But like, if you look at the moon and the Earth, the moon actually does cause Earth to wobble a little bit, because both pull on each other, but the point that you're rotating around is still inside of Earth.
And but not Earth doesn't. And if you were able to do a time lapse photo, or if you do a time lapse photo, you really don't see the Earth wobble.
Yeah,
it looks like just the moon going around in a circle.
Earth
around
is pretty
fixed,
big.
A fixed body.
No, so the orbitational is also inside Pluto.
Oh,
it's
it
not
is.
That large a difference of the moon. Yeah, it's not.
Okay.
Yeah. It does
Apologies,
wobble.
Apologies, I misread
it doesn't
that.
Wobble. I would say that if you were going to have a declaration of a binary planet, when and if we find one, we almost definitely will find them, or dwarf, you know, binary dwarf planet, whatever you want to call it, I think that would be kind of the rule. You've got to have the orbital point be outside of the mass of both of the objects, right? Because then you really do have a polarity in the sense that, you know, which one do you call is orbiting which? Hmm. But when you have a situation where one is orbiting and the other one's orbit center is actually inside its mass, then I wouldn't say it's doing any kind of orbiting. It's just wobbling.
Actually, I'm looking at an animation here that seems to call that
into I'm looking
question.
At a video.
Yeah. Well, we'll post this up on the website after the show. You decide.
It's nice. Really nice. All right, actually, we have some more space news.
That's
though,
so like 8 pixels.
Yeah, but that's enough pixels to know.
Hey, if you're
an astronomer, please tell us.
Yeah, right. Someone call in, please. Now, if you're upset about Pluto being considered not a planet anymore, can move to Illinois. You can move to Illinois, where the Illinois General Assembly passed some legislation calling Pluto a planet again, which is ridiculous. Like,
because science is always decided by popular consensus.
Yeah.
That's exactly how it doesn't work. Okay, yeah. since we're talking about Pluto, let's get a little closer. Let's talk about Jupiter's moon. What's your favorite moon again? Is it Io, Ben?
No,
The
only thing I can remember.
Io has to be the favorite of every geek.
I can't remember
awesome.
The name. And I'm thinking
see what I did
it's so
there?
Blocking.
I can't remember the name of it. It has a funny name, but the only thing I can think of is Snuffleupagus, which is not...
The one looks like a walnut, right?
Character.
Anyway, what's going on with Io?
Enceladus?
I think that's it.
Miles?
Enceladus? I'm looking
what's
it up.
Going with, what's going on with Io right now?
Io
Iapetus.
Is lighting up.
Iapetus.
Okay. It is lighting up with volcanoes.
Its own volcanoes?
Yes.
Huh.
Well, we actually already knew that Io had volcanoes.
I thought its volcanoes were like liquid water. Or,
ice
Europa. Water. Europa. Right.
Io was actually the first volcano we ever saw that was outside of the planet Earth. This was discovered decades ago. Well, this is unusual, though, because 3 volcanic eruptions have happened within a short proximity of one another, and all 3 of them are within the 10 largest ever seen on Io.
Whoa, what's going on there?
Very, very large bangs.
Hmm. Now, this is kind of neat because it actually shoots its erupta into outside of its orbit, right?
Yes.
That's our goal.
Yeah, ejecta.
Ejecta. Thank you. Wow, that's pretty cool. So these videos, of course, are available too. Ars Technica has a really interesting article and write-up about Io's moon, or Io, the moon of Jupiter, shooting out these giant volcanoes. And how close together were these? I mean, in the sense that were they around the planet in different areas, or are they all in one area of the planet? Do you know?
No, they're all, if you're looking at the moon from one from one side, they're all on the same side.
Whoa. Maybe it's taking
They're
off.
Actually at a very, very close proximity to one another relative to the size of the body.
Huh.
In fact, one of those is kind of within the corona of the largest one. Corona, wrong word for it, but yeah.
The glow.
Yeah.
All right, let's go on. We've got a few more minutes, so we can do a couple more space stories. what's this? Let's talk about people who can do here on Earth. Is there anything they can do right now to take a look at astronomical events?
Yes. As it turns out, the Perseids are coming back.
Perseids. I was waiting for that so I could correct you.
Really?
Because normally you correct
really?
Me.
Really?
Look it up. I just did to confirm what I knew. Perseids.
Okay.
Anyway, meteor shower. Awesome, awesome, beautiful.
I
don't know.
Corrected.
I'm just saying
He's
words.
Absolutely right. Perseids. Yeah.
Wah, wah.
What the heck are they? Gosh, guys, stop arguing. Tell me about them.
They're a meteor shower. From Wikipedia, the Perseids.
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 Oh, no.
I'm going to have a hard time with this one. Are a prolific meteor shower associated with the comet Swift-Tuttle. The Perseids are so called because of the point from which they appear to come, called the radiant, lies in the constellation Perseus.
Okay, so let's break this down. First off, that's right. Most meteor showers are actually us passing through the tail of a comet, because as the comet gets knocked by the solar winds, particulates get knocked off of it. Mm-hmm. Those particulates hit our solar atmosphere,
the tail, yeah.
And they go whoosh, and they light up, yeah. And they're really pretty.
So find out where the constellation Perseus is. Look in that direction. And from between tonight and the August 14th is going to be the height of it, and you're going to have a pretty good show. They're
what
very
time
consistent.
Okay, so, and it's the entire time you can see that constellation. Because as our orbit, as we're orbiting, we're colliding with these particulate matter, and the direction of that collision, like if you look from Earth straight out to where the collision is happening in the solar system, you're going to see that star system, that constellation. It has nothing to do with them coming from the constellation. It's just that that's what's behind it when we collide with it.
And
so we'd have to see when the constellation is actually rising so you could see it. And that would determine what time of day it would be available. And the geeks are clearly looking that up as I'm speaking, I'm assuming.
Well, yeah, basically when to view the best time is just whenever the sky is the darkest. So
well,
if you want
that constellation is visible.
Well, of course, mm-hmm. of course, yeah. So if you can see the constellation and it's really dark, I mean, if you want to be really good about it, you can wait at 4 p.m. or something, or 4 a.m. or something. But
right.
I'm not that dedicated.
This is GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me was Ben Jaffe and Miles Elam. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and used with permission. GeekSpeak is also Creative Commons, share and share alike, so you can do anything you want with our content. Just enjoy the show.